After accepting the instruction of Devarshi Narada, my mother stayed in his care, without fear from any direction, as long as my father, the king of the Daichas, had not become free from his severe austerities. And text 14, which gives us the purport for today. Rishim pariyacharat tatra bhaktya paramaya sati antarvatni swagarbhasya kshemaya yecha prasutaye. My mother, being pregnant, desired the safety of her embryo and desired to give birth after her husband's arrival. Thus she stayed at Narada Muni's ashram, where she rendered service unto Narada Muni with great devotion. Srila Prabhupada's purport. It is stated in Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th canto, 19th chapter, 17th verse, Matra swashra tuhitrava naivivikthasano bhavet balavan indriya gramo vidvangsam api karshati. One should not remain in a secluded place with a woman, even one's mother, sister, or daughter. Nonetheless, although one is strictly prohibited from staying with a woman in a secluded place, Narada Muni gave shelter to Prahlad Maharaja's young mother, who rendered service to him with great devotion and faith. Does this mean that Narada Muni transgressed the Vedic injunctions? Certainly he did not. Such injunctions are intended for mundane creatures, but Narada Muni is transcendental to mundane categories. Narada Muni is a great saint and is transcendentally situated. Therefore, although he was a young man, he could give shelter to a young woman and accept her service. Haridas Thakur also spoke with a young woman, a prostitute, in the dead of night. But the woman could not deviate his mind. Instead, she became a Vaishnavi, a pure devotee, by the benediction of Haridas Thakur. Ordinary persons, however, should not imitate such highly elevated devotees. Ordinary persons must strictly observe the rules and regulations by staying aloof from the association of women. No one should imitate Narada Muni or Haridas Thakur. It is said, Vaishnavera Kriya Mudra Vigye Na Bujhai. Even if a man is very advanced in learning, he cannot understand the behavior of a Vaishnava. Anyone can take shelter of a pure Vaishnava without fear. Therefore, in the previous verse, it has been distinctly said, Devashir Antike Sakuto Bhaya. Kayadu, the mother of Prahlad Maharaj, stayed under the protection of Narad Muni without fear from any direction. Similarly, Narad Muni, in his transcendental position, stayed with the young woman without fear of deviation. Narad Muni, Haridas Thakur, and similar acharyas, especially empowered to broadcast the glories of the Lord, cannot be brought down to the material platform. Therefore, one is strictly forbidden to think that the acharya is an ordinary human being. Guru Shru Naramati. Srila Prabhupada has three functions to perform when he writes his purports. One is to stay faithful to the previous acharyas, and he does that by faithfully reproducing the balance of their instructions. So if two out of three acharyas bring out a particular emphasis on a particular Bhagavatam verse, you'll find that in Prabhupada's purports. Prabhupada is meant to be the transcendental via media, the transparent via media. A via media, one time they asked Prabhupada, what is a guru? And he had his spectacles, and he said, now I can see. And he put on his glasses, and he said, now I can see better. He said, this is the guru. You can see, because Krishna is within the heart. Krishna is the original guru within the heart, giving you instruction. So why do you need a guru on the outside? You see? Because sometimes you don't listen. So glasses go on the outside, transparent. They're definitely transparent. If they weren't transparent, can't see through. And it's a via media to seeing something better. So Prabhupada makes himself like the last lens of a telescope. A telescope, how many lenses in a telescope? Anyone have a telescope? No, I didn't think so. I wouldn't imagine what brahmacharis could use a telescope for in the ashram. So the telescope has many lenses, And you shouldn't think that the last lens is not important. The last lens is very important because it allows you to receive the light from the lens before it. So in the same way, the Guru Parampara is like a telescope, seeing something very far away. And it is a multiple number of lenses. And the last lens is as important as the first lens. And they are all transparent via media for the distant object which you wish to see. In this case, the distant object is so far away that even if you ran towards Krishna at the speed of light, you'd never reach him. So far away. And yet he's so close to you that he's giving you instruction every day. And it's the guru's duty to echo that instruction on the outside, what you're hearing on the inside, and then hopefully between the two of them, between guru and Krishna, some sense will stick. Like my father always used to say to me, he used to say, you throw enough mud at a wall, some of it is bound to stick. That was particularly when he told me something over and over again and I didn't do it or I didn't understand it. He said, if you throw enough mud at a wall, some of it is bound to stick. So if you hear the guru's instructions, even up to the point where it's almost insulting, some of Prabhupada's purports, even in one sense you could say they insult the intelligence with repeated reading. Now, what do I mean about this? Because Prabhupada is telling us something so basic that sometimes we find Hindus come to us and they say, why Prabhupada has to speak like this to me? I know these things. I don't need to read these things. I know these things. Well, this is because Prabhupada has many tasks to fulfill. One is to give us the most elevated understanding from the verse in the Bhagavatam, and one is to give us the most basic understanding. So the most elevated understanding is Bhagavat Ashraya. Take shelter of the Maha Bhagavat. Take shelter of Krishna through his representative. And accept no substitutes until you reach the person who is the best representative of Krishna, and you have the best situation in which to do that. And the most basic instruction that you would teach to people is find yourself a situation, young men, seems to be addressing the young men here, that where you can find freedom from the association of any distractions. And chief distraction for a young man is the beauty of a young woman. And why does Prabhupada need to say this to us? Well, while Prabhupada was writing these purports, he was addressing a lot of young men. Our movement at that time probably still is, actually, because we still don't make the Hare Krishna movement very friendly for young women, do we? If you look at our statistics, you will find that we are two-thirds young men and a third young women. Because a lot of the young men really don't want the company of young women. And so when they try to join our movement, sometimes they say, no, we have no room. You see, that is a problem for us. And then when it comes time for the young men who are severe and austere brahmacharis to become married, there are no fully qualified young women for them to marry. So they have to find somewhere else, which causes further difficulties. However, that's my personal things, which I will try to be transparent via media and not to give you personal opinions in this class. So Prabhupada is preserving the words of the Acharya. Of course, he's taking the words of the Acharyas out from the Sanskrit and Bengali into modern English. And Prabhupada is fighting the main demons of the age. The main demons of the age, so that his purports will themselves give ashraya and be an ashram. So that wherever you are in the world, by opening one of Prabhupada's books, you will immediately be in the sanctified atmosphere of an ashram. He's giving various instructions all in one purport. The highest level of instruction to those who require it, and the lowest level of basic information to those who require it. And there are many things that could be said about this selection of verses, but Prabhupada here is talking about What was Prabhupada's main demons that he was slaying with the sword of knowledge? It was said that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati came to give pure love of Krishna. Well, he said, actually, he said, but all my life I've been cutting away at the jungles of impersonalism. Impersonalism. And what was the other thing? Sense gratification. Oh, yes. So impersonalism and sense gratification. And when you mix those two things together, they're like a heady cocktail. Don't think that a person is either strictly an impersonalist or strictly a, you know, sense gratifying materialist. Unfortunately, there's a spectrum. There's a spectrum of possible deviations in those two categories. And somewhere in the middle are the Jati Gosais and the Sahajas. And of course, from Bhaktivinoda Thakur's time onwards, our acharyas have been fighting with the pull exercised on the general devotee community from these different directions. Sahaja means to think that I've already reached Krishna in some way. It's a development of the stage that Vishwanath Chakravarti labels as Utsaha Mayi. Utsaha means enthusiasm. That's a good thing. Mayi means Maya. That's a bad thing. So Utsahai means the illusion of enthusiasm. How can I be illusioned by the enthusiasm for Krishna? Well, because you may be so enthusiastic for Krishna that you think you have reached a stage that you have not reached. And therefore you begin behaving in a particular way. So this Utsaha Mayi becomes compounded into a philosophical position. And what happens is that people begin to practice Krishna consciousness, if unchecked, uncorrected, in a particular way. Now, the difficulty is that then they set up their own sampradayas. And at the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, there was 13 such sampradayas, all with different deviations. All with different deviations. Even eating of meat was there and seen as being a servant of Lord Nityananda. This is the situation at the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Taking the tulsi leaf, putting it on the fish, and offering it to Lord Nityananda Prabhu in the name of Krishna Bhakti. We won't even go into the rest of the things. So, like a knife, the acharyas had to cut through all these things. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur used to take the melodies of the bowels, the owls, the bowels, the kartabhajas, the sakibekis, the chudadaris, all these different sampradayas. He used to take the melodies of the songs, the popular songs that they used to sing, and he used to put his own songs, his own words to them, and then distribute the printed words. And with that, and everybody would know the melody. They put the melody at the bottom and people would introduce them. And he used to sign off sometimes the insignificant bowel. In other words, it was a little bit of propaganda. He didn't even used to sign his name sometime. He wanted people to think that they were singing bowel songs. Because everybody knows, oh, the bowels are coming to our village. Great, that's going to be fun. When the bowels come to your village, you know it's going to be a good old sing-song. They're going to sing, maybe there's going to be some dancing. And they know how to, you know, there's funny songs. You know, there's comedy songs. There's dancing songs. There's clapping songs. There's songs that, you know, divide up the audience and the men sing and the women sing and all these different techniques that you would use to get the whole village going. But unfortunately, the conclusions in those songs are not pure bhakti, not pure conclusion. Sometimes in order to get money from people, you write amusing songs, but you're not, you know, because the conclusions of pure devotional service are not always easy to listen to, you see. Like a purport like this, particularly saying, you know, don't associate with women. This is not, you know, for 98% of the population, it's not a very good read. They'd rather read a Mills and Boone, you know, Mills and Boone romance. He gazed into her eyes across the room. She returned his gaze. Oh, sir, how your eyes penetrate my heart. later that night he met her on the veranda, and on and on. The most popular form of writing in the world. You can make an awful lot of money by writing for Mills and Boone. It's not very difficult. You just have to know how to manipulate the mind of the reader in a particular way. So if you're after money, these books are not very good books to sell. That's why it's one of the greatest achievements to go out and sell them. That's why we glorify those devotees who actually go out and sell these books, because basically what's in them, nobody, it's not good news for anybody. Except those people who are actually looking. And there's always sufficient people who are looking. So we will always have customers. But the difficulty is, if you were standing on the street with some romantic novel, then people would be queuing up. You see? So there's a different quality in the literature. Literature for crows, for the kakas, and if you're Gujarati, kaka doesn't, kaka means crow. Not, not your uncle. So, literature for the hamsas, the swans. So you can take your pick. But the literature for swans is not so easy to read, because it will address itself to the most difficult areas, the most difficult attachments. It's like going to visit the dentist, and the dentist tells you, oh, such and such, such and such, I'm afraid we're going to have to fill in the dotted line. Or the doctor says, I'm afraid I've got some bad news for you. So a lot of men, particularly men of a certain age, don't go to the doctor. They put off going to the doctor. And doctors just, you know, it's a perennial problem that men who really need to go to the doctor, women go to the doctors, but men don't go to the doctors. So men over a certain age, millions and millions of pounds are spent in the United Kingdom to get messages across to men who don't want to hear the message. Because normally when you reach 40, 45, 50, it means that the doctor's going to tell you to give up something. And men don't want to hear that. It's either cigarettes, alcohol, or rich food, or take more exercise. All of these are things that, you know, men of a certain age really don't want to hear. So they don't go to the doctor, because they know that that's what the doctor's going to say. So people don't open a purport, one of Prabhupada's, because we know what it's going to say. We know that it's going to be difficult to read. May give some interesting information, but really, it's going to tell me something that I don't want to know. And therefore, we have to listen over and over again to Prabhupada saying things. Please read my books. Distribute my books, yeah, that's all right. We know he said that. But please study my books every day. You see, that's the hard part. And so that's one reason why they will come to the temple, but they may not come to the ashram. What we have in our ISKCON movement is called a mutt. For the Hindus who come here, it is a temple, a mandir. Well, let's not sell ourselves short. The difference between a mandir and a mutt is profound. A mutt is a place where people live and they serve the deity. Not all temples are like that. You go to South India, you'll find both mandirs and mutts. And if you come here and you think Bhaktivedanta Manor is a temple, then that's all you'll ever get. You'll just get darshan. If that's all you want, that's all you'll get. You see? But if you come here and you think, ah, there are people who live here who are actually deep practitioners of the path of devotional service, maybe I could ask them a few questions. The fact that you don't, my dear visitor to Bhaktivedanta Manor, means that you may not like the answer. Because the answer that they will often give you is that you have to give up something. And that's the difficulty. Why don't people like sadhus coming to their house? Well, they do as long as they can just have a superficial relationship with them. Sadhus come to my house, I put on my best sari. Well, not me, obviously, but I get rid of the smell of onions. I I cook a few extra jalebis and samosas. I behave in a particular way. The sadhus behave in a particular way. We both cheat each other and the sadhus go home to the ashram. This is superficial. Sadhu means that he must cut. A sadhu during the visit must say something that actually cuts the householder a little bit. But you better make sure that you're a mature sadhu. Because if you're an immature sadhu and you say the wrong thing, you'll never be invited back. So how to say something which is actually relevant, but still get invited back? This, my friends, is the art of preaching. You say it with a smile on your face. You smile and you make a joke about it. So, and you say something. So it is important. These messages are important. You have to have the bedside manner of a doctor. But first, you have to be living the life yourself. The general rule is that you can never tell anybody to do something that you're not doing yourself. That's called hypocrisy. Religion is very good for hypocrites, but we're trying not to be hypocrites. This ashram life prepares you for telling others to do it. Why? Because in ashram life, you get some enjoyment. There is actually some enjoyment. Speaking as one who did live in an ashram at one time, you could say, I still have an ashram called the Grihastha Ashram. That's another story. But I fully experienced the Brahmachari Ashram. And Brahmachari Ashram, of course, is experienced by many of us when we first come to Krishna consciousness, when things are new and they're fresh and our eyes are being opened and there's newer and newer revelations at every time. So the idea of the modern ashram is actually something, it's relatively new. Sometimes we think, when we read these purports, that the ashram was just like this ashram. Perhaps that there was a mandir attached to it. There'd always be a mandir of some kind, but it wasn't open to the public. There's three different types of ashram, actually. One is what scholars call the Puranic ashram. One is the medieval ashram, and one is the modern ashram. And there are distinctions between them. The Puranic ashram is the guru and his wife, normally. And that's why when Narada Muni gives instructions on brahmachari life, he mentioned the guru and his wife. You see, later on, Narada Muni gets into discussing the different ashrams. So although here we have a picture of course, Narada Muni, the head brahmachari, more than a sannyasi, actually, traveling and traveling and preaching all over the universe. But he also has an ashram. So we get the picture that it's like a modern ashram where we have a resident sannyasi and brahmacharis, etc. But the classical Puranic ashram was the guru and his wife. And the guru normally didn't have a gilet, razor blade, and a good supply of shaving foam where he lived, because the guru was in either a place where the public had no access. He wasn't just off Junction 5 on the M1 as we are here. So forget nice Hindu visitors coming to bring you adequate supplies. This was nuts, fruits, and berries ashram, living in the forest or on the mountain or by a river, or somewhere where the public had no access. Why? Because you don't want the public to come. Why? Because it's an ashram. So there's a difference between living in an ashram and a preaching mission which runs a mutt. What we have is a mutt. We call it the Brahmachari Ashram, but actually it's a mutt, which means that we do weddings here, basically. And we have lots of visitors, and we have big festivals. So Puranic ashram means not that type of ashram. It means the guru and his wife. My God, how can the guru have a wife? Well, because he's married. That's why he has a wife. And his wife lives with him in the forest. And he has a beard. And he has long hair. But he knows the Vedas. And you go to him. And if you are a Brahmin, brahmachari, you stay there for years. If you are a Kshatriya brahmachari, you may stay there for weeks. And if you're a Vaishya brahmachari, you may stay there for a matter of days only. But while there, you will live like they live in the ashram. How do you live in an ashram? I forget the verse now. But you live like a, what is it? Kaka snan. Kaka means crow. Snan means bath. While living in the ashram, you bathe like a crow. A crow picks up some water in its beak, throws it over its back. Cold water, not hot. No shaving foam. No luxury sandalwood soap from Mysore that someone brought you back. As the crow picks up some water in its beak, throws it, and preens itself very, very quickly. Just 1 minute. So while living in the ashram, kaka snan. Then, why? Because baka dhyan. Baka means the crane or the heron who's standing so still in the water, you think it's a statue. In fact, you don't know whether it's a real bird or it's a statue. So this is how meditation is to be done. Fixed, one point, like a crane. So kaka snan, baka dhyan, and then, what is it? Swapna. Swapna nidra? Is it swapna or swanidra? Swanidra. Sleep like a dog. Sleep like a dog. It doesn't say bear or dormouse. It's, and that is not including hibernation. It says sleep like a dog. Sleep like a dog because, why? Because a dog, you can make the smallest sound. You can make the smallest sound and the dog will wake up. So the dog is sleeping, but it's always alert. So in the ashram, the brahmachari in the ashram should take a bath like a crow after sleeping like a dog and go and do his meditation like a crane or a heron. So then the other one is eat very little. Eat very little. And what's the last one? Do you know the last one? Oh, Grihatyag, yes. And the ashram should not be your own house. It should be someone else's house. Okay. Excuse me, Hare Krishna. It should not be your own house. It should be someone else's house. Why? Because in your own house, there's always a tendency for comfort. So the whole point here is that everybody should live in the ashram. Everybody should live in the ashram. Means that wherever you are, you can apply these rules as much as possible. So you live with the guru and his wife. And it is said that you regard the wife as your mother, your young man. And then Narada Muni says something very unusual. He says, if the guru's wife is young, she should not bathe the brahmachari or oil his hair. And under what circumstances could we possibly imagine that happening? Well, the guru's wife might be young, and the brahmachari might also be young. So then you've got problems, because brahmacharis, it says, should not have the association of women. So why would the guru's young wife be looked? Because the guru wife might be younger, and the brahmachari, he might be a Vaishya brahmachari going to live in the forest for a little while, just like they still do in Thailand. Boys, when they're 9, they go for a couple of years, or when sometime, you know, after 9, they go to become monks for a while. It's quite a thing to become a monk in Thailand. And you have a brahmachari life, and it's a kind of national service, even though the ruling party in Thailand is now, you know, pretty much at war with the monks, because the monks don't like them, and there's just these thousands and thousands of monks all over the country. It is a good thing for some part of your life to live in the ashram. Make the most of it, because I can tell you it doesn't really last very long. So this is the Puranic, and when you read of Jaimini Rishi, and Devala and Asita and Vyas, this is the Puranic ashram. Then the medieval ashram comes after Lord Buddha. And Lord Buddha and his followers made something called guhas. And these guhas were where what would previously have been sannyasis. You see, a brahmachari is not a sannyasi. Sometimes we get it all mixed up. So a lot of times brahmacharis come to me and they say, oh, you know, in the ashram, I'm living a life of renunciation. No, you're not. It's not a life of renunciation. It's a life of preparation. A brahmachari life means the life of a student. And the only reason is you're celibate is not because you're renounced. Renunciation comes, it's a different level of detachment. You're a life of preparation. Yes, you may choose to remain a brahmachari, and that's fine. But you will also go through progressive layers of detachment, which at a particular point will become fully mature renunciation. But just because you wear saffron, which is a very recent thing, actually, to wear saffron, it only goes back to the 1930s, but we'll have a more of that in just a second. So the traditional sannyasi, of course, he does the greatest level of griha tyag because he leaves his griha for good. And it's four different levels of detachment. First of all, he lives in the same village and his wife brings him his meals. Well, that's not a very great sannyasi according to ISKCON standards. Then someone else brings him his meals. Then he leaves the village and goes begging in scheduled houses so that he knows that he's definitely going to get a meal. And then he goes traveling and begging so that he goes to different houses who may or may not give him meals. This is his major concern. Central heating is not the concern of a sannyasi in traditional India. Central heating is not a concern. It's a major, major expense for those of us who live in the cold part of the world, isn't it? But food is, you see. But you can always depend on charity. One time, was I a brahmachari? No, I wasn't. In 1986, I was on Brajmandal Parikrama. And boy, was that tough. That was really tough. Anyone done it? It's a barefoot, 128-mile pilgrimage. And every day you've just got to walk. And who knows what you're going to be stepping on. And I've got very sensitive white man's Western, you know, feet. And you have to become a bit rough and tough. But the point here is that I could always rely, even when I was hungry, to ask for food. Bhavati bhiksham dehe is the catchword for a brahmachari. Bhavati bhiksham dehe, please give a donation. That's what brahmacharis say. So rotli and gore and a little bit of, you know, vegetable would always be forthcoming. You could eat any time of the day. They would always give a pilgrim something. They always had something. And householders, say the sannyasis, their tendency is always to say to a brahmachari, eat more, eat more. I always like to eat more. Because they know that with every mouthful that the brahmachari eats, they get blessings from the gods. So brahmacharis, they just have to make sure they don't eat too much when visiting the householders. So sannyasis would travel. That's the whole point. Sannyasis don't stay in one place. You see. A woman who, what is it? A woman who laughs in public. A Brahmin who is living in luxury, and a sannyasi that doesn't travel, these things are not very helpful for society. Sannyasi who doesn't travel is said to be like a river that doesn't flow. It soon becomes overgrown with weeds. So a sannyasi that doesn't travel, he becomes overgrown with weeds of attachment. So he has to travel. And in light of the Bhagavat, we find that a sannyasi travels and he leaves no trail behind him. He's like, just as a bird flies through the sky or a fish swims through water, both of them leave no trail in the air or the water. So a sannyasi leaves no string of attachments behind him. So in this way, the sannyasis move. However, when Lord Buddha created, not exactly Vedic sannyasis, but the same type of thing, saffron-clad monks who didn't believe in the Vedas. They did live together for the purposes of reciting the non-Vedas and becoming a source of power and influence. And this led up to the medieval times. And in that situation, we find that the practice, certainly by medieval times, was to have sannyasis living together. Certainly by the middle of the 800s, when Shankaracharya was preaching, he had his sannyasis not only travel, but to congregate together in holy places where people could hear the message. Because for him, living a life, a spiritual life, was not the most important thing, as getting the message of a spiritual life over to people and bringing people back to the Vedas from the Buddhism that had conquered India. So if you're interested in getting a message over to people and you're a sannyasi, don't go and live in the forest or on a mountainside, because you'll never meet anybody. Go to the marketplace where people live, you see. And better still, form a place there. So all the pilgrimage places in India became captured by Shankarite sannyasis. That's why when you go to Jagannath Puri, the Shankaracharya lives there. When you go to Dwarka, Shankaracharya lives there. Badrinath, Shankaracharya lives there. Rameshwaram, Shankaracharya lives there. Even though those places were made sacred by the touch of the personality of Godhead, the supreme personality of Godhead deniers are actually living there, you see, in all these major places. And that's why when Ramanujacharya came along, he also had to set up places in holy places of the Vaishnavas that had been put there by the Alwars, which is a parampara of great lovers of Godhead who wrote thousands and thousands of hymns glorifying the beautiful personal attributes of Sri Krishna in his different incarnations. And they went to at least 108 or 106, rather, different places all over India. So Ramanujacharya, then, he was very involved in regularizing the worship in those places so that they never became conquered by Shankarites. And so he set up ashrams in those places. And just as Saint Benedict set the rule for the monks all over Europe, the Franciscanis, the Cistercians, the Cappuccini, all these different types of Dominicans, all the different types of monks and nuns that we have, they work to a rule. What you do when you live together. Because living together is not the same as living in your own place. Everything is shared. Time you get up is shared. Your prayers are shared. Everything is shared so that you can be stronger together. And in the case of a missionary order, you can be more influential. So Shankaracharya knew that he had to do two things: to regularize the teachings so that everybody was teaching the same thing, to regularize the shastra so everybody was reading the same thing, and regularize the worship so that everybody's puja was doing the same thing. Why? So that at no time in the future could the Shankarites again come along and invade the holy places. So in the holy places, the ashrams became a place where a sannyasi now lives, or two or three sannyasis now live. You see? But here, you know, brahmacharis are still dressed in white or yellow, because a sannyasi is the only one who dresses in saffron, because he's renounced. You see? Okay, so then we wind forward, we go forward to Madhva, 200 years later. And Madhva, of course, he did the same thing. And he did it in places where the Shankarites actually lived, like where they had their strong point, like the Shankaracharya was in Sringeri, and he wanted to battle all over the state of Karnataka. And so this is what he did. He preached against Shankaracharya and won the state of Karnataka. So then we go forward and we find that the teachings of the six Goswamis included, do not dress in saffron. Do not dress in saffron, Sanatan Goswami says, because saffron simply increases the pride. You see? But we have them living together in an ashram and teaching and preaching. But there still doesn't seem to be a great deal of traveling. Lord Nityananda's followers were traveling, whereas the six Goswamis weren't traveling. You see? So we go forward to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and he saw that the greatest modern phenomenon of traveling, preaching, sadhus, was the Ramakrishna mission. And the greatest tradition of sannyas was the Ramanujacharya mutt. And so he combined the two in the Gaudiya mutt. And so for the first time in history, we find brahmacharis wearing saffron and wearing kirtas. Never before had that happened, that a brahmachari would wear a kirta, because standard clothing for a brahmachari is just, well, cloth. There's a particular brahmachari dhoti that you wear, which is very simple to put on. Actually, the brahmacharis in ISKCON now wear grihastha dhotis that have been tied in a grihastha fashion, but dyed saffron. And they wear the kirtas, also of a merchant, or a man about town. This was because when brahmacharis and sannyasis go into the world, they are dealing with certain types of people. The gurus don't have beards, we are shaved clean. But in this way, what we've inherited is a compound of different traditions. However, the main thing here is that we find one or two or three things stay the same. One is that the principle is ashraya, to take shelter. The place where you take shelter is known as the ashram, and one who has taken shelter is known as an ashrita. And it said that one who is an ashrita is a person whom God smiles upon. He knows why you're there, and he knows that you've gone forward in order to learn things and to surrender something. And that's why living in the ashram is daily surrender. When do we surrender? Different schools of Vaishnavism, they spend thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of verses just discussing this principle over the centuries. When is the point of surrender? Is it at initiation? Is it a later point when you say, Krishna, now I'm truly yours? Is it when you become renounced? What is the point of surrender? I suppose we would say it is a continual process. Continual process. From the day that you first surrender your independence in some way to the day when you surrender everything, having been fully conquered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But ashram means that you should be able to gain freedom from distraction. You see? Now, of course, in our ashrams, we have a difficult situation, do we not? We have freedom from the pressures of the world, but we also have pressures to go out into the world to give Krishna consciousness to people. Therefore, later on in the seventh canto, just in this section, see, Prabhupada is giving a running commentary of ISKCON at the time when he was writing these purports. A lot of his sannyasis, this is 1976 when Prabhupada's writing these purports of the seventh canto, and a lot of sannyasis had had different, should we say, turbulence upon the flight back to Godhead. So Prabhupada wrote in these different sections. At the time there was also discussion of whether one could wear non-devotional clothing. And of course, we always call a dhoti devotional clothing, as if somehow or another, you know, putting a dhoti on made you devotional. If that was the case, then it would help me greatly. All I had to do in order to feel devotional was to put on a dhoti, and for the ladies to put on a sari. However, unfortunately, there are many prostitutes in Bombay that wear saris, and there are many unscrupulous men who are lechers who wear, and that's not lecture as in giving a talk, but lechers who are extremely lusty men who wear dhotis. So a particular type of clothing has to come with a particular state of mind. And that's the thing. And sometimes it's all locked up together, isn't it? Sometimes when people come to the ashram, we train them for life in the ashram. And then when they leave the ashram, they go home, as most do, we find that they have difficulties actually practicing Krishna consciousness because the clothing is different. The idea of putting on a certain type of clothing and practicing Krishna consciousness has become so locked tight. So really, I think we should have a training day, Chaitanya Jivan, where people just wear the clothes that they're going to wear for the rest of their life, and we just train them for life outside the ashram. Because if you don't train a person for life outside the ashram, don't be surprised if they can't practice it outside the ashram. Just a little consideration there. But the ingredient of the ashram is simple life, meditation, clean life, early rising, and the association of a Mahabhagavat or his representatives, and the association of God, freedom from distraction, and freedom of sexual turbulence. These are the things that are being brought up in this verse. And if someone's not living that way, if someone's having a young lady come into the ashram who's pregnant, and she's waiting for her husband to come back, don't be critical. You who know how to live in an ashram, don't be critical that Kayadu, the wife of Hiranyakashipu, pregnant with Prahlad Maharaj, has now moved into Narada Muni's ashram. Don't become critical just because you could not do that or live like that or welcome a young woman into the ashram. Does not mean that everybody is like you. Narada Muni is not like you. You should not try to judge Narada Muni by your own criteria, you see. But neither does it mean that when, at the end here, Prabhupada says, you shouldn't think that the Acharya is an ordinary human being, Guru Shru Naramati. You should not think that, my Guru Maharaj is also an Acharya, therefore I should never, ever, ever question when he has young ladies in his room until hours into the night. I should never question this. I could not do it, but he can surely do it because he is a guru, therefore he's an acharya. No. Actually, the earliest reference I have found to a disciple not giving up the powers of discrimination, it's not in Narahari Thakur's Krishna Bhajanamrita, but it's in something that was written in 1250 by someone called Pillai Lokacharya, who was a follower of Ramanujacharya. And Pillai Lokacharya says that the disciple should never give up the powers of discrimination and can at times take the guru to one side and say, Guru Maharaj, this was not appropriate. This is not, people will talk. This is not. So this was written in 1250. So there's a long line there of not giving up on the powers of discrimination. It's a very fine line. It's a very fine line. But we have seen that kshurasya dhara nishita duratyaya, that we have to utishta jagrata, we have to wake up, but at the same time we have to be careful because life in this world is a kshurasya dhara. It's a razor's edge. Just this side and you're completely Krishna conscious. Just that side of the line and you lose your Krishna consciousness. You see. So does a disciple have to keep his acharya, Guru Shru Naramati? Well, both things are there. And that's why we balance. That's why we balance. Because actually we're all in this together. We're all in this together. And gosh, you know, sometimes it seems hard how to press forward, doesn't it? It seems hard how to press forward. But in this particular purport, Prabhupada said, don't question the motives of the guru of the ashram. Otherwise, then it becomes very difficult for you to be an ashram member. Yes, it becomes very difficult for you.